Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hello, hello. Off speaking, welcome back to the Macro Trading Floor. As always, with me, my good friend, Brent Donnelly. How are you doing, Brent?
Hey, Alf. I'm probably doing a little bit worse than you, but I'm still doing decent. Thanks. Thanks for asking.
Well, we were discussing about me being in the south of Italy here with 20 degrees and in a t-shirt, and Brent is wearing a hoodie, like, you know, there is -5 Celsius outside. But, you know, the perks of being a southern Italian sometimes. Let's talk about Mr. Williams, though. Mr. Williams is a heavyweight at the FOMC. You know, he's the serious guy you listen to when he changes his mind. And, you know, like the serious guy at the Fed, I would say, on top of Powell, of course. And he just said something along the lines of, if data warrants, the Federal Reserve might actually hike as the next move. Uh-oh, he's opening up the distribution again. So all of a sudden, you don't know if the next move is a hike or it's a cut, which is something we covered last week. So, Brent, what do you make of it?
Yeah, it's really interesting timing given what we discussed last week, which was that as long as that part of the distribution does not exist in the mind of the Fed or in the rhetoric of the Fed, then it feels pretty safe to be all in on reflation and commodities. But if they are actually serious about opening up that part of the distribution, then that changes everything, because then you could get more like a regime like 2018 when Powell said we're a long way from neutral, even though that was a mistake. Or 2022, when obviously we had no idea of how many or how fast rate hikes were going to come. There's a little bit of debate in the market about whether this is a watershed comment or not. In my mind, it's important because 2 days ago, Powell said, if higher inflation does persist, we can maintain the current level of restriction for as long as needed. At the same time, we have significant space to ease should the labor market unexpectedly weaken. So that's a clear description of a distribution that only has one side, right? He's saying if inflation is persistent, we'll keep rates high, but not hike. And now Williams is saying that strong enough data could warrant a hike. And to me, I mean, he could have easily just said what Powell said. He could have said, so it's not like it was out of context. I read the question, I read the answer. And to me, it was not out of context. He was answering a question that he had a choice, and he made a choice to say that hikes are possible when he could have simply said, hey, listen, rates are very restrictive here. All we have to do is keep holding the vise nice and tight and things will get squeezed. And instead, he actually opened up the idea of hikes again. So to me, I think it's important.
Yeah, I tend to agree, because Williams is a guy with very, very measured takes normally. And when he willingly talks about the possibility of hikes, it means there is actually an open up in that part of the distribution. Now, to be clear, it's not like markets are pricing a 0% probability of a hike. They're not. For clients at the Macro Compass, one of the things I do is update this option implied distribution of Fed cuts or hikes over the next 12 months. And already a week ago, this was about 25% priced in probability of a potential hike. Now, 25% is not 50, it's not a base case, but, you know, it's kind of a fattish tale. And I think today we are at about 30 as I speak. And tomorrow I'm going to update again. But, you know, it's now becoming a reasonable probability being priced by markets. So that means that Williams is validating, let's say, that this is not a small tail. This is actually a possibility. You're not going to surprise market from 0 to 30, because we are already at 30% probability, but it's something to take into account, I would say, because markets don't like uncertainty. When there is uncertainty about the future path and the path is not narrow and predictable, they tend to price in more risk premium, which also makes sense.
And I think that's an important point that you make about understanding the distribution and trying to extract it in a more granular way using options, because what people do in markets generally, and even market professionals who know what they're doing, is we tend to talk about how many cuts are priced in over the next year, but that can look very different depending on what the distribution is. You know, if we see 2 cuts are priced in, but the distribution goes all the way from 6 cuts to 4 hikes, that's a completely different thing from 6 cuts being priced in and it goes anywhere from 2 cuts to 10 cuts. So I think the way that you do it, the way you look at it, is really good. And I think Bloomberg should update their WIRP function to do it the way Alf does it.
No, because otherwise I'll lose clients, Brent. So please, Bloomberg, don't listen to it. Come to Alf, people, if you want the distribution. No, just joking. I think one thing we should discuss, though, Brent, is a theory that I've heard a lot, actually from also some of your friends at Spectra. They've been very early in this, I would say, is the theory by which if the Fed ends up hiking, actually they will stimulate the economy more. So, sorry, what did Alf say? Yeah, I said hikes are stimulative. At least that's the theory, right? And we touched upon a little bit last week, but I have gone through it to try and show how this might work, right? And the idea is this. So how do hikes normally bring down economic growth is by making debt servicing costs higher. And as you have a higher mortgage installment to pay, or a corporate has a higher corporate loan rate to pay, they will hire less, you will spend less money, and so the economy will slow down. Economics 101, right? But what if this time that isn't happening? If you look at the debt service ratio, which is a statistics the BIS is openly publishing, the debt service ratio in the United States has gone up from something like 10% to 15%, and it's measured, let's say, as basically as a ratio, as a hit to the disposable income for the private sector. Now, let me give you an idea. The Federal Reserve has hiked from 0 to 5%. And if you look at a similar hiking cycle, for example, prior to the great financial crisis, the debt service ratio was well north of 22, 25%. So I'm saying this basically to show that this time the hikes are not feeding through nearly as fast as they were in 2007 to the US private sector. With Brent, we talked about why is that. You guys have no floating rate liabilities in the US. The refinancing cycle is very long and stretched because everybody and their mothers have locked in a 30-year mortgage rate, et cetera, et cetera. But hey, if hikes aren't feeding through on the liability side of the balance sheet, they are surely feeding through on the asset side because you can invest at 5% risk-free rates. And so the net impact is, funnily enough, temporarily stimulative. That's the theory. And now, Brent, please say something about this.
Well, yeah, I think that theory has been gaining traction, and there was an article that went kind of viral on Bloomberg about it this week. Now, I guess the question, if we just take that at face value, which I don't know if I'm willing to do that. To me, it's more a question of the long and variable lags have become longer is more what the issue is, not necessarily that rate hikes don't eventually lead to some kind of transmission to a weaker economy. But let's just say that right now, and maybe for the next year or two, while everyone's still locked into low rates, that rate hikes are stimulative, then what's the Fed supposed to do? Cut rates to tighten policy? Like, it's such a convoluted theory that, and I'm not saying it's not true, but it's so convoluted in terms of what the appropriate policy response is. I suppose it would just be to keep rates up here until finally the transmission happens. But if that transmission takes 2 years and CPI is back at 4.2%, then you have a problem.
Yes. And I think you're right, because we can debate all these theories and whether they have merits or not. But in the end, if you're the Fed, one thing you have to try and do is to impact the liability side of the private sector balance sheet. So you have to make borrowing more expensive for people, new borrowing more expensive, refinancing more expensive. Now, cutting rates isn't going to do that for sure.
No.
Hiking rates, or keeping rates at a very high level, yes. So if this theory is actually correct, then I think the most intuitive and important consideration that comes out of it is that the Fed will have to implement higher for longer for real, exactly like they did in 1995, 1998, where they basically only cut 3 times from the top and then kept rates at the same level for 3 years. That's a true higher for longer. Or in 2007, where they basically paused for 15 months before a new cut in 2007. If that's correct, I think that's the most important implementation of theory here, is that higher for longer is here to stay. Again, this is something that is gaining traction now. Why are you hearing this now when the market has already moved the distribution towards that? I mean, there is nothing to gain, or not much risk reward to gain, I think, by marrying that very unorthodox thesis now. Maybe 2 months ago. 2 months ago, it would have been a brilliant trade.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the challenges I think right now, like specifically right here, right now, is that the dominant narrative is kind of priced in. And if you look at something like divergence between ECB and the Fed, so essentially the ECB has pre-announced they're going to cut on June 6th. The Bank of Canada looks like they're probably going to cut in June as well. The Fed is not. So that's a classic monetary policy divergence trade. But then if you look at the metrics that I look at, the market's extremely long dollars. The dollar has had a lot of momentum. But then when you zoom out, really the dollar's been in a range for a couple of years and we're still within that range. So you have a lot of repricing, but then what's going to get the dollar, you know, what's going to get euro dollar to 100? It's not going to be a cut in June. That's already priced in. It's not probably not going to be the cut after that. It has to be something else. Either the Fed, people think that the Fed could hike more than they do now, or something bad in global manufacturing or in Europe data. But the European data has already been kind of middling. And to me, so there's a lot of crosswinds where you have global manufacturing cycle is kind of bouncing, looks okay. And with the US kind of where it is now, it's like, okay, well, are we going to go all the way to zero cuts priced? I mean, maybe, but we're not going to get that in the short run because the back end of the month tends to have very little important economic data. Like you get NFP and ISM at the start of the month, then you get CPI in the middle. And you only get PCE at the end, but PCE is very easy to estimate once you have CPI and PPI. So what you tend to see is the second half of the month, there's lower volatility than the first half of the month. That's an empirical fact. Like if you look at ranges in S&P 500 or ranges in dollar yen, the front half of the month tends to be more volatile. And I think this month's kind of a classic version of that because you look at everything that's priced in. The market's long a lot of dollars. People are doing the divergence trade. And that doesn't mean that you want to be short dollars or flip, but it does mean that the next 2 weeks or something could just be a big consolidation, I think, of the existing narrative, just consolidating, but not accelerating. And just one other thing I would throw on top of all that from FX is that you're getting a lot of pushback now on dollar strength, specifically from Asia. But then at the IMF meetings this week, even Yellen kind of piped in that acknowledging, not necessarily supporting Asian comments on strong dollar, but acknowledging them and not pushing back on them. So she has a choice when Japan complains about dollar yen, she has the choice of either saying FX should reflect fundamentals, or she can say we acknowledge the concerns of the finance minister from Japan. And she chose a second one, which I think is mildly interesting because Japan will always rather intervene with US, with the nod from the US. And so to me, this gives them the nod.
Yes, and also we have the magic 154 number now in dollar Japan, and you know this magic 10 figures in a month type of thing always floating on the background. You never know when these guys are coming in. But hey, if we have to talk about volatility in the second half of the month, I would like to throw some curveball to you, which is the quarterly refunding announcement, which is planned in 11 days, 11 to 12 days. So exactly that's the end of April. Which might bring in some vol, because we have two important things coming at the quarterly refunding announcement. One is Secretary Yellen telling us how much of the Treasury General Account she wants to drain. I mean, is it going to be a lot? Is it going to be fast? Or is she going to wait for the second half of the year? The tax season in the US is proceeding pretty well. The Treasury General Account is on its way above $1 trillion, which is quite a large amount. So she could decide to spend money from there, rather than issue bonds to fund deficit spending, right? There are two ways in the end for her to deploy the approved deficit spending program. She can either issue bonds, but the debt ceiling suspension only lasts until the end of this year. So at some point, she will run a bit short of room to issue new bonds. Very funny because it's a self-imposed rule by the United States. I mean, there is no reason why Yellen cannot issue more bonds unless a self-made rule called debt ceiling, but okay. And therefore, she might have some political cover, right? To say, well, you know, let's drain this TGA. It's very large anyway. It's 1 trillion. So we'll hear something about that explicitly, about the target for the TGA at the end of the month. And also, importantly, the distribution of issuance. She's going to keep flooding the market with T-bills, which are very easy to absorb. You know, there is no duration risk. It doesn't take a lot of value at risk and limits and anything from dealers to absorb T-bills, or it's just going to finally move to a more spread around issuance, which includes issuing more long-dated bonds right when 30-year yields are already north of 4.75% as we speak. So it's just going to risk another term premium tantrum like we had in the September, October last year, or is she's going to play it safe? And, you know, the tinfoil hat theory is that she's going to play it safe because she wants Biden to be reelected, and therefore she's going to do anything she can to accommodate financial conditions through the quarterly refunding announcement. I think that can be a bit of all.
Yeah, that's an interesting period because you're going to get the QRA. And just for context, many people believe, including myself, I guess, that QRA that at the end of October was the cap in yields. And I think most people believe that. So it obviously can be very important at the end of this month. So you're going to get that, then you're going to get ISM, then you're going to get FOMC all within about 3 days. So that's going to be a super interesting period. And just a little bit of a micro thing, but because realized vol has been so high lately, the curve is actually inverted in a lot of stuff, which doesn't really make that much sense if you just look at the events coming up. So that's an interesting setup that because things have been moving so much, vol is very high right now, but really the next couple of weeks should be actually vol dampening. And then the real vol comes very late April and early May.
Yeah. Tend to agree there. Hey, Brent, at Spectra, you wrote some pretty interesting piece on the new hedges or the look for hedges. I mean, what the hell is a safe haven these days? Because surely bonds aren't working for a couple of years. So shall we talk a bit asset allocation, like pretend that we are running some sort of CalPERS type of asset management thingy, right? You and I, two bold people trying to make sense and run a balanced asset allocation mandate. What the hell is going on? Like, what are the hedges? What are the protection in your portfolio today?
Yeah, I was thinking about this because of the equity sell-off, and then the performance of bonds relative to equities has not been a good hedge, obviously, since 2020. And part of it all comes down to, like, I can go through the look back and tell you what happened in the past, but a lot of it comes down to what you expect in the future in terms of regimes. So if you're thinking it's going to be fiscal dominance, MMT, structurally higher inflation, then 60-40 is not going to work very well because the bond side is not going to help you. And I looked at pretty much all the standard safe havens like that, or things that people think are safe havens. So like gold, yen, Swiss, US dollar, bonds. And then I looked at Bitcoin and silver just for shits and giggles. and the story broadly is that we have a big shortage or an acute shortage of safe assets right now. So bonds have been negative since 2020 as a hedge. They haven't been a hedge. Gold has not really worked because it's trading more like a risky asset. Generally, when liquidity is plentiful, gold goes up and Nasdaq go up. And that's not always true, but that's been the case since COVID. And then Swiss and yen have not worked at all because they're connected to bonds. And also because their central banks, specifically the SMB, have been intervening or messing around in the currencies. So those currencies haven't worked. The US dollars worked decently well, but again, that's not permanent because it worked very poorly in the early 2000s, which you could argue is a similar time to now where capital flowed into the US and the dollar ripped higher in 98, 99, 2000. Then capital flowed out and the dollar went lower even as stocks were cratering. From when the Nasdaq went from 5,000 to 1,000, the dollar went down because it was money flowing back out of the US. So if you go through all of those, and then Bitcoin is not a safe haven. Maybe one day it will be, but right now it's just a risky asset. It's very, very similar to Nasdaq. So if you go through all those and then you say, okay, well, I want stocks in my portfolio, obviously, but then what am I going to put in to play some defense? It becomes very difficult because the only thing that really has worked in recent, like over the last 10 years, or especially since COVID, has been long dollars. But in a world where NASDAQ, say, goes down 40%, let's just say as a theory, the dollar probably is not going to rally in that environment because the money that has flown into, you know, TINA, there is no alternative, and US exceptionalism and Mag 7 and Fangman and whatever you, all those acronyms, as that money flows out, it's going to be negative dollars. So maybe I'll just throw it as a question to you, but if I have an equity portfolio and I've got my 60, let's say, then what do I do with the other 40? Because if I think MMT is a permanent fixture until it finally blows up, which I do, and I don't think that blow up is necessarily going to be fun or soon, then what do I do with the 40?
So the first thing I would say, Brent, is that if you have 60 in equity, you should have 80 or 90 somewhere else and not 40. So you should make prudent use of leverage to make sure that your diversifier and your portfolio are large enough to matter, because equities are volatile. They run at about 18% annualized volatility, right? And all the other assets you have mentioned, gold, the dollar, bonds, they're all less volatile assets, right? So if you want
right.
them
to defend- Can I just interrupt for one sec? That was a critical aspect of risk parity, and a true 60-40, of course, doesn't just have 40. So you have to use leverage because the vol is so low in your hedges. If you're long dollars in 40, then that's not going to help your 60. Right. That's sorry, so go
right.
ahead.
That's so right, Brent, because if you look at the 60-40 portfolio, the contribution to risk of that portfolio is 85 and 15 because the 40% in bonds actually, you know, bonds are less volatile than equities normally. So 60% equities actually means 85% of the risk of the volatility of your portfolio is represented by equities. So to right. match that 60, you don't need 40 of something else. You probably need 80 or 90. Okay. So in other words, you need to lever up the defenders, right? That's how it works, or the diversifiers. And I have done a lot of work on this. It's a fascinating topic, and it has produced something that I call the forever portfolio. And what it looks at is basically a bunch of diversifiers, because the diversifiers that tend to work, as you highlighted, that tend to work at different macro environments, and it's very hard to predict what the next decade is going to look like. So here, you and I, we're starting from the assumption it's not going to look like 2013 to 2019. Otherwise, you know what your defender is. It's bonds. You only need to do more than 40, a bit more duration, levered up, so match the volatility of equities, and there you go. But bonds and bonds serve as a diversifier to equities only if core inflation is on average below 2.5%. So if you are in a moderate growth, predictable, low inflation environment, in history, bonds serve as a very good diversifier for equities. Great. But now what if growth isn't coming from the US? Growth is coming from outside the US. So that's the 2000 to 2004 scenario, where money is flowing out of the US and into something else. Equities are going down in the US, 2001, for example. Then what is your diversifier? Well, in that case, it used to be commodities and emerging markets. So you start to understand that your diversifiers can be assets or can be geographies. So in that case, it used to be emerging markets as a geography and commodities as an asset, right? If you're running an inflationary environment, for example, commodities can be a great diversifier, gold can be a great diversifier, bonds will be a terrible diversifier. The dollar can be a good diversifier, as you said, if the world is deleveraging, for example. So basically, the asset classes that can serve as a diversifier are plenty. Commodities, metals, the dollar, emerging markets, bonds, and a few more, okay? And my point is, in a portfolio, you should try and have all of them in an equally weighted volatility type of setup, where all of them are able to contribute and defend your drawdown in equities in a certain macro environment, right? And then our job is to try and identify what will be the next most likely prevailing macro outcome so that we can tilt the portfolio a little bit more towards that particular defender. And so lately, the defender that I've worked have been two. One has been the dollar. The dollar has been a good diversifier lately, after the pandemic, after the COVID. For example, in 2023, you were having at some point stocks down and bonds down very aggressively going into September, October. What worked? The dollar. The dollar worked. Right now, you're having bonds down, equities down again over the last few weeks. What's working? Commodities. So you see how many of these guys can provide diversification, and I think you should have all of them in a portfolio sized appropriately in a way so that they can actually defend your equity drawdown.
And, you know, maybe the benefit of what you're describing is that it doesn't really require a forecast. So you're trying to, instead of forecasting the weather, I guess to quote from Bridgewater, but you're trying to build something that's all weather. And then, of course, if you have a strong macro view about what's going to happen, you can tilt, you know, the hedges appropriately. But in the end, what you're really talking about is building an all-weather portfolio of a bunch of diversifiers, and some of them won't help you, but it, depending on the regime, the other ones will, and the other ones will help you more than the bad ones are hurting you.
Yeah, that's correct. So the idea is to always have a good proportion of what I call right drift assets. So these are assets that tend to go up over time. And believe it or not, equities tend to go up over time because earnings go up over time and the world has not ended yet that I'm aware of.
You know, one thing that raised my eyebrows a little bit was you mentioned EM, which most people would view as an offensive asset. But in fact, because of the fiscal and other considerations, EM actually performed very well in 2022, for example, when the dollar was going up and risk was tanking. For example, Mexico did surprisingly well. So maybe that's a consideration too, is that the old way where emerging markets were financed short dollars and they had a ton of dollar debt, a lot of those dollar debts are not as significant anymore. For example, like Petrobras covered a lot of their dollar debt and similar in a lot of emerging places. So to me, that's an interesting and a little bit counterintuitive thing to add in it can be defense or offense because something in EM can be positive carry, which will do well in low vol. But then if it's stable, even if it doesn't rally, but if it's stable in when risky assets are selling off and you're still earning the carry, that's not a bad little piece of the puzzle as well.
Yeah, this is the same as calling commodities a defender. I mean, commodities are a high volatile asset that tends to do well when nominal growth is doing well. But at the same time, they can be the only defender in certain situations, right? So my point is you should have a portfolio that has a lot of different players that are able to do different things, really defend and attack whenever you need them to. And between 2001 and 2004, emerging markets completely crashed US assets. Am I saying this is going to happen again? I don't know. That's the point. So the beauty of a portfolio like this is that you can sit on, I don't know. And this portfolio has delivered over the last 24, 25 years, an average return of 8% with an 8-ball. So you're talking about pretty decent set of assets and a pretty decent return out of this portfolio without having to predict that the US will dominate or emerging markets will dominate or inflation will be high or inflation will be low. It's important to build a portfolio that I think is equipped for many type of weathers.
Quoting. Right, that makes sense because there definitely is a world where inflation is influenced more by technology and demographics. And we're just still on the very back end of the COVID shock. And those forces, those structural forces end up reasserting themselves and the cyclical forces lose their mojo. And all of a sudden inflation's at 1.6 and you're wishing that you were long bonds. So that's an interesting way of doing it to capture all the different regimes from at least the ones that we're familiar with from, you know, 1990 to now would all be covered by those assets that you described.
Now we've had a very philosophical discussion and why don't we bring it into more practical terms? So what do you like for the next few weeks, Brent?
So in the short run, I like Euro yen and sterling yen lower. Part of it's where we are on the chart. Part of it is that Kanda, who's one of the officials in Japan, said that 10 yen in a month is kind of like a line where they would get interested, and that would be 156 in dollar yen. So instead of being short dollar yen in a world where Williams is putting hikes on the table, I'd rather be short a different currency and long yen. So sterling yen and euro yen shorts, I think, look very good. They don't absolutely rely on intervention because the entry points are very good here anyways. But obviously, some part of the expected value is going to come from an expectation of intervention. And to me, I would say the MOF at some point will have to put something behind what they're saying. Like, they understand. I mean, they've been doing this for a long time. They know you can only jawbone so many times and then you have to do something. So I feel like dollar yen's at 154.60 right now. Between here and 156, I think the MOF will sell dollars. And so you can benefit from that with euro yen or sterling yen, but it gives you a little bit more staying power if the dollar is just rallying on its own.
Yeah. I like the yen story because the risk reward and the asymmetry here is quite interesting, which is the key in most good macro ideas is to set up a trade which has a positive expected value. You know, you can still lose money and the MOF doesn't show up, but the odds are they will, basically, and therefore the risk reward in the trade looks pretty good. Talking about risk reward, I don't have a trade in particular that I want to push this time. I'm still making my laps around and getting my applauses for Dollar Brazil. Please come. I'm waiting for my applause. Just kidding. But what I'm looking at here is rates, because now the distribution has already moved towards hikes. So, and you hear more people talking about it, right? So it feels to me like we are in the last innings, and I have this idea that Secretary Yellen will show up with some nice presence in the QRA. So my playbook, if I can get one done there, is to have 2 years well north of 5%. Everybody is basically assuming the Fed might as well hike next. And then I get Yellen to help me, and she might push an entire financial loosening into markets back again. So at that point, I mean, you might buy bonds, but you might buy anything that is an asset, equities, gold, bonds, you name it, Bitcoin, you can buy anything at that point. I'm not pulling the trigger yet just because the trend is completely against it. I mean, you have rates selling off every day, stocks not doing particularly well. So why would you want to try and front load this too early? My ideal scenario is where I can do this a few days before the QRA, with nobody talking about the QRA yet. And maybe CNBC goes out with a special that says yields are headed to 13%. I mean, that would be the cherry on the cake. Let's talk about some nice things or interesting things we read this week. What's yours?
So this is a kind of a stupid and an interesting thing. So the stupid thing was, I was Googling where you are in Italy, and then somehow we got on the topic of mozzarella, and I've seen, I'm not very well versed in food. So I've seen mozzarella di bufala or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was maybe a region or a nickname, like the way buffalo wings are, you know, obviously not made from the wings of a buffalo. But then you informed me, which I was surprised to learn, that that mozzarella is actually made from the milk of a water buffalo that's native to that part of Italy. And I didn't know that. And sometimes I'm just blown away by like very obvious things that I feel like I should know. But even after 50 summers of existence on Earth, I did not know that.
So I'm waiting for the next newsletter of yours at Spectra coming with a picture of a buffalo that says, "This is what I learned today. Alf showed me that this is a water buffalo producing the milk that is used in the mozzarella from his hometown." By the way, funny story, these buffalos we have over here, they produce an incredibly good milk. So we're really famous for mozzarella in the place where I come from. And it's so good that 40 years ago, some Australians, which were on holiday here, they tasted it and they were like, "Whoa, what is this? We want to, you know, export this mozzarella business as well to Australia." So they actually took a couple of our buffalos, put them on a plane, flew them to Australia. But, you know, buffalos didn't want to know it. Like, what the hell is this? This is not my southern Italian weather here. So they actually didn't produce good enough milk when they were exported back there.
When they put them on the plane, was it coach or first class?
I have no idea, buddy, but probably first class. And the other funny thing I read this week is that a client asked me, "Alf, I mean, I really want to understand why 2% inflation. Like, why? Can you tell me why?" I'm like, "I don't know, man. It's not an interrogatory. I'm going to Google it. I don't know." So I went on Google and I wrote down why 2% inflation. And Google said, "Oh, take a look at New Zealand, 1989. I'm like, "What?" So I took a look at it. And the story apparently is that New Zealand came from a couple of decades of high inflation. And then, you know, they had enough of it. And so the finance minister and the government said, "We need to get a handle on this. And, you know, if we don't get inflation towards a controllable level, you set a target. If you don't get it, you're fired," they said to the central banker. So they went with the finance minister. They were like, "What's the number? Like what number shall we target? You know, inflation was double digit back then. So what number should we target?" And the guy said, "Zero." I said, "Oh man, zero is too low. We're at 10. So what, 3? Yeah, 2. Is 2 a good number? Yeah, 2 sounds good, right? Yeah. And then they went out with 2%. That's the story. I mean, Brent, can you believe this?
And that's macroeconomic orthodoxy all around the world now. It's amazing.
Because apparently they actually went to 2% inflation pretty rapidly, which is completely a coincidence. And then a few other central banks were like, "Wow, this works. If we tell 2% to anyone, they will anchor their expectations around 2%, and all the wage growth and anything will be indexed around this idea that inflation should be 2%, right? So it works. And I guess that today we're talking about 2% because of that. The European
and some people say economics is a science.
The European Central Bank, Brent, says something like 2% is comfortable enough and far enough from deflation. Well, 1.5 and 2.5 as well. So why two? Again, there is no scientific explanation for why two. This is where the world we live in, ladies and gentlemen.
Amazing.
I have exhausted my funny stories between mozzarella and 2%. Any parting words?
The only other thing I'll mention is take a look in the show notes. I wrote a piece about this shortage of safe assets thing. So you can see a bunch of charts and the backward evidence of how the different safe havens have performed since the year 2000.
All right. We'll put Brent's article in the description for you to have a look. And said that, I would say that's enough for this Sunday. Sunday, it's Friday. Thanks for listening to us. I swear I'm not drunk yet, but I will be in a few hours. And we'll talk to you next Friday then.
All right. Thanks, Alf. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you next week.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.